Okay, well, hello and a very warm welcome to everybody on today's call. We've got quite a few people on the webcast and also dialing in on the phone line, so thank you very much for joining us today. And welcome to Ask the Expert teleseminar. This is number two in our series so far. My name's Faye Hollins from OutshineConsulting.com and TheSuccessTools.com, and I have the pleasure of being your host for this teleseminar today with finance expert Kate McCallum from Multiforte. Now, just before we start, if I could ask everybody on the telephone line that's dialed in just to press star six to mute themselves out of this call. That way, if you're shouting to the dog to sit down or to your husband and wife to start cooking the dinner, we're not going to hear you. So please just press star six and then we won't be able to hear what you're saying. Okay, so Kate, I've known Kate for about a year now, and the reason I asked Kate to do this call is because in my job as a coach, I come across a lot of people who aren't on top of their finances in many varying ways. And having got to know Kate and her business, Multiforte, I really felt that there were a lot of synergies between what many of my clients and newsletter subscribers were hoping to achieve financially and the expert advice that Kate provides practically in her day-to-day practice. So I know that today she's got a wealth of smart and practical tips to share with you to help you beat the money issues that are keeping you awake at night. And that's what today's call is all about, the burning money issues that are keeping you awake at night. Now, I encourage you to listen through to the very end of today's teleseminar, whether you're on the live call or on the recording, because Kate's got a very generous bonus gift that she'll be giving listeners of this call later on today. So we'll announce that at the end of the call after she's answered your questions. Now, before we get going, I just want to tell you a little bit about Kate before I bring her onto the call. Kate's a very experienced money and finance professional. If you read the profile from the marketing efforts that I've gone through, you'll know she's got a heap of experience as, you know, a money and finance professional and a business speaker. And she's got over 15 years professional experience in superannuation, investment, insurance and financial planning. So she's worked with leading Australian financial services organisations, including State Street, Commonwealth Bank and Westpac, to name but a few big names on her resume there. Now, Kate's been responsible for managing superannuation and investment products and services for a range of clients, from large employer superannuation funds and investment managers to business owners and individual investors like yourself and I. And Kate has focused in the past 4 years on financial advice, developing these services at Westpac Financial Planning. Now, very much with a desire to help people grow their understanding of super and investments and gain control of their finances, Kate believes that there's a real opportunity to make a difference to the quality of financial advice available to you. And her company, Multiforte Financial Services, works with people like you and me, and that's how I've got to know Kate, people who are professionals and small business owners who want to start making smarter decisions with their money. Now, what's different about Kate's approach is that Multiforte take a stand against commissions, and this is something that was really important for me when I first met Kate. So instead, Multiforte simply work on an agreed fee so that you can feel 100% confident that the advice you get is in your best interest and not all about commissions. Now, Kate holds a Master of Commerce and postgraduate qualifications in applied finance and financial planning, and she's very much a budding sailing and yoga enthusiast. So without further ado, I would like to send a very warm welcome to Kate on the call. Hi, Kate, are you there?
Hello, Faye, how are you?
So is that worrying moment? Is the expert on the call or not? I'm great, thank you. How are you doing today?
Very well, and hello to everybody on the line. It's fantastic to get such great questions, and they're quite broad-ranging, so I think we'll have quite an interesting journey through various aspects of finances this afternoon.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to this because I get to host these calls, but I then get to sit back and get all this wonderful advice, and I know that you've got a wealth of information to give us tonight, so thank you for that. Now, just before we get on to a few housekeeping points before starting, can you tell us, Kate, why you think this topic has raised so much interest today?
It's an interesting one. We often find that, you know, looking at your finances is something that people put on their priority list somewhere beneath cleaning out their sock and undie drawer. But in the current market, we're in, I think, quite a unique environment. We've actually gone from a very, very buoyant economic environment for many years, particularly in Australia, to one which is I would call very subdued. You know, it's kind of a once in a 10-year occurrence where we have this type of recessionary environment and share market fall. And what that then means is that we're actually seeing significant changes in people's buying behaviour and businesses' buying behaviour. It's happened very quickly, and I think it's taken a lot of us by surprise. And so then for all of us, whether we're business owners, employees, you know, we're all investors and consumers to some extent, we actually then realise we need to shift our patterns and our habits, which I know is something that you talk about in a broader sense, but financially we need to do the same. And so I think people are sort of going, well, hang on, this is different, and they're looking for guidance at a very, very practical level. And that's certainly what we want to be able to do today.
Brilliant. I love that word, practical, stuff that you can put into place and get moving on as quick as possible. Brilliant. Okay, so just before we crack on and let Kate start answering your questions today, I want you to do, everyone on the call, to do four quick and easy things for me. First of all, I'm just going to repeat myself one more time. Please make sure you press *6 and put yourself on mute so that we can't hear you on the call. And the second thing I'd like you to do is please make sure you've got a pen and paper in front of you, because Kate's going to be answering a lot of your questions today, one by one, and you're going to want to take notes. This is, it might be a free call, but it's content rich and there's no sell on this call, so it's all about giving you practical tips that you can put into place and advice that you want to hear. Now remember, the palest of ink is better than photographic memory, so please make sure you've got a note sheet and a pen at hand so that you're ready to take lots of notes as Kate starts talking. Now, thirdly, as Kate starts revealing some of her top tips, I want you to think about how you can quickly implement some of the strategies that she reveals, because what you know isn't worth knowing if you don't take action on it. So it's great to sit back and listen to the advice today, but start thinking about how you can quickly implement some of the advice that Kate gives you. And finally, I'd like you to make a deadline to implement at least one of the tips that she reveals on the call that's relevant to you. So that's how you're going to get the most out of today's teleseminar, by committing to taking action on the strategies that you're about to learn. Okay, now I just want to give you some context around how this teleseminar and the Ask the Expert teleseminar series came to be. Now what's about to happen didn't just come from my mind or Kate's mind. This came from the collective minds of everybody that's been interested in this call, so everybody that's on the teleseminar today and who registered for the teleseminar. And that's thanks to a methodology that's 2,600 years old, so it's a pretty proven technique, and it's courtesy of Socrates. And we asked you a very important question. That question read, what's the biggest money issue that's keeping you awake at night? So without further delay, we're going to get stuck into your questions. And what we've done, because we've only got around 45 minutes today and Kate can't answer all of your questions in that time, we've picked some of the most common questions that seem to apply to the majority of listeners so that everyone on today's call can get value from the teleseminar. So just because Kate isn't answering your specific question, it's still really important to focus and to listen and to avoid multitasking at all costs so that you can get the most benefit out of the next hour you're about to invest on this call. Okay, so the questions that we're going to cover today, I'm just going to quickly nip through them before Kate starts giving her answers. The first one is, what's recommended for folk already invested in the market following the significant market and economic falls? Great question. Number two, I feel guilty that I'm not doing more to save when I retire. Should I be worried? I'm with you on that question. Okay, number three, people talk about tapping into the money vault above you. The money will flow to you when you create an idea that provides value to people. Can you explain this? Number four, I'm not very good at budgeting. How do I get control of my spending? And that's one that a lot of my clients ask me, so I'm pleased that that came up. Number five, my issue with money is not having a high pay currently. I want to find ways to leverage my income and create passive income. What can I do? Number six, what is the best way to make money in a recession? I'm sure we'll be all very pleased to hear about that one. What's the best advice you can give to someone right now who's in business for themselves about managing cash flow during slow periods? Great question, because I know we've got lots of business owners on the call today. And finally, number eight, I'd like my accountant to be more proactive. What can I do? Brilliant questions. Now, before we crack on, Kate, I know you've got a general advice reminder for us that we should start with, haven't you?
I do. So bear with me, everybody. But because the area of financial advice is so heavily regulated, I do need to remind you that what we discussed today is general advice only. So it's general information and advice only. It doesn't take into account anyone's personal circumstances. And we need to remind you that if you do want to act on any of the advice in relation to you personally, then it is a recommendation that you seek professional financial advice for your own circumstances.
Great. Completely understand that. And general advice is good, so thank you for giving up your time to do this today. So let's get on to these brilliant questions. So the first one for you, Kate, today is, what's recommended for folk already invested in the market following the significant market and economic fall?
That's a really good one, and as you said before, Faye, it's one that has come through several times in different guises. I think this question for me highlights the despair that a lot of people feel at the moment, but also thankfully a recognition that the right response to this market downturn is actually not to sell out, not to sell out of your investments and jump into cash, because that would actually crystallise your losses and make them real. So rather it sounds like the people who've asked this question are actually looking for practical things to do, so you're in the right place. Now, as I said before, I can't answer this for anyone personally, but what I will do is give you some general information to give you an idea of sort of where we're at and what you can do. Now, with this particular question, bear with me, the answer is quite involved, so it's going to be a long answer, but what I'm going to do is break it into a few parts just so that you can follow where I'm at. But I don't want you to miss out on any of the parts, so as I said, just please bear with me.
So I should have said before, everybody on the call is going to get a recording. So if you're panicking to get everything written down, don't panic. You're going to get a recording of Kate's call tonight. But please do write some notes because there's going to be some great tips coming up for you now. Sorry, Kate, over to you.
No worries. Thanks, Faye. All right. So first of all, I think it's important to recap why selling out of shares and jumping into cash is not usually the best response. You know, you hear that quite a lot, you know, don't jump out of the market. So let's actually understand why it's not a good response for everybody. First things first, when you invest in growth assets like shares, you should have the expectation that they will be volatile. So that is that they will go up and they will go down. And that's why when you invest in the likes of shares or listed property, you should expect to get an extra return. So that's what they call your risk return premium. And everybody's heard of the risk-return trade-off. You take on extra risk, you should expect to get extra return. Now, in the past 30 years, the Australian share market has actually experienced 8 downturns. So that's 1 every 4 years, which tells us that we shouldn't be surprised when the market does go down. Now, in that 30-year period, you know, probably 1 in 10 years we should expect a bigger fall like the one that we've just had, which is, you know, on par with what we experienced in 1987, and there was one that was a similar sort of downturn in the 1970s, which is before I was working in this industry. But, you know, do remember, shares and listed property, they're designed to be long-term, and the aim is that you invest in these, and if it does turn down, that you've got time to wait out any downturns before you need to sell. Now, when these sorts of downturns happen, unfortunately, our natural human behaviour is actually to panic and to react and not to patiently sit there and wait till the downturn turns around. You know, we experience fear, we experience stress when our value declines, and I'm sure many people have felt that, and we have an auto-behavioural response. You know, stress causes our thinking brain to shut down, and our automatic response is, you know, typically fight or flight. And so we are hardwired to jump out of a fearful situation and go to the safety of cash. But what that means is that you then do turn these paper losses into real losses. You actually realise the loss, and people talk about crystallising losses. And what that then means is you're sitting in cash, you miss the opportunity to take advantage of the eventual upturn. Now, also at the moment, I should emphasise that sitting in cash is probably not a very good strategy because the cash rate in Australia is just over 3%, and inflation is not far behind. So inflation, in fact, is probably eating away just about any return that you're likely to get from sitting in cash. Now, the upturn in the market, you may not feel at the moment that things will get better in any sort of fast time frame, but we do know that share markets recover over time. Their long-term trend is upward, and in the last 30 years, the Australian share market has actually delivered average annual returns of 12.8%. That's nothing to sneeze at. That's even with the downturns, the average annual return, 12.8%. The other important point right at the moment is that history also shows us that when there's been a downturn like we've experienced, the upswing can easily be in the order of a 50% return. And
wow,
again,
you should have pricked up then.
Yeah, you don't want to miss out on that. And look,
no.
You know, if you look at the Australian market, we've already seen from the March low an upswing of around about 25%, and the US, the Standard & Poor's 500, from the March low has actually already increased by 40%.
Wow.
So from the low, we've come up 40%. Now, obviously, that's a different 40% to the 40% down because that was off a high, but you can see the magnitude of these upswings. And we're still seeing daily volatility in markets where the market does move, you know, 5%, 4% in a given day. You do not want to be out of the market when those upswings are happening. Mm. So that's just recapping the reason why jumping to cash is not a sensible decision for most people.
Yeah.
Okay, now secondly, let's get on to the practical stuff. Given that situation, what can you do to improve your money, ideally without taking on unnecessary risks? So you don't want to start finding yourself in interesting schemes to try and get return. Now, I'm going to share with you three things that you can do, and I actually did a whole webinar on this just last week, but I'm going to capture these fairly quickly. So three things that you might want to write down. Number one, get your asset allocation right. Number two, strip any unnecessary fees or costs from your investment. And number three, avoid at all costs any hidden taxes that might be present in your investments. Now, I'll walk through each of those one by one. So let's start with asset allocation. Get your asset allocation right. I'm sure you're familiar with asset allocation, but just to ensure we're all on the same page, it's basically about how you allocate your money across the four main asset classes, and that's shares, property, bonds or fixed interest, and cash. So shares, property, bonds or fixed interest, and cash. So they're the four main types. Ideally, what you want to do is spread your investments, and I'm sure you've all heard of diversification and not putting all your eggs in one basket. So you want to spread your investments. You want to diversify so that you reduce the risks of any one of these four asset classes going down and taking your money with it. Now, asset allocation is important because it's one of the three drivers of the performance of your investment. So when you invest money, there are three things that drive your performance. One is asset allocation, and the other two are market timing, so when you choose to go in or out of the market, and stock selection. So that's whether you're choosing particular stocks like, you know, BHP or Johnson & Johnson, or even if you're going into managed funds, it's about the managers that you choose. So that was market timing, stock selection, as well as the key one, asset allocation. So I've got a quick question for you. So just make a mental note of your answer in your head. What do you think the difference that asset allocation makes in your portfolio? So I've got some multiple choice questions for you. So do you think that asset allocation drives about one-third of your returns, which is answer A, so roughly the same as market timing and stock selection, so they're all about equal? Or B, does asset allocation drive half of your returns? Or C, does asset allocation drive more than 75% of your returns? So you've kind of got equal market timing, stock selection, asset allocation, or that asset allocation actually has its unfair share, that it's half, or a seriously unfair share that it's actually got, that it drives more than 75% of your returns. So make a mental note of your answer.
A good question, it gets you thinking.
Yeah. Now, many people are actually surprised to find that the answer is C. Mm-hmm. So congratulations if you got that right. What we find is that most people don't know how big a deal asset allocation is. I reckon it's one of the investment industry's best kept secrets. It actually accounts for somewhere between 85% and 95% of your investment returns. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, something as simple as working out which of those four buckets your money should go into drives 85 to 95% of your investment returns, which doesn't leave much left over for stock selection, so which stocks you actually invest in or which managed funds you choose, or market timing to do. So market timing goes back to what we talked about before, about not trying to pick when you get in or out of the market, but staying the course. So my key message is you have to get your asset allocation right if you want to make money out of investing. Now that begs the question, how do you actually do that?
Tell us, Kate, tell us.
The one thing to note is that there's no one ideal asset allocation. This is not a one-size-fits-all. It's very, very individual. And you individually need to work out the returns that you want to achieve versus the risk that you're willing to take on. Now, we've got risk profiling tools that we typically use with our clients to help them work it out. And what we find is that most people don't actually know what their risk profile is, so, you know, how much risk they're willing to take on. You may have heard these talked about as, you know, I'm a growth investor or a high growth investor or I'm a conservative investor. They're the types of language that you'll hear around risk profiling. And what we also find when we run a lot of seminars, we do a show of hands about how many people have then invested in line with their risk profile. And we did one just last month. We had about 55 people. About 10 people knew what their risk profile was. Two of them actually were invested in line with it, and one of them was a client of mine. So, you know, that just gives you an idea of how well, you know, this is a kept a secret. It's really quite amazing, and yet it's so simple to do. That's what's magic about it. You get your risk profile right, you invest in line with it, you're actually doing 85 to 95% of the work that you need to do in your portfolio.
I think that's such an important point generally. You know, I'm just talking from a general coaching perspective now, but often people don't spend time thinking about how much risk they're willing to take to achieve what they want. And it is a really important question. Often we, you know, we want everything, we want it now, but we don't think about how much risk we're willing to take to actually get there. So from a financial perspective, working out what your risk profile is and feeling happy with that is really important information to know.
It is actually, and Faye, it's a really good point because it's another reason why people panic when the market turns down. You know, so what we've seen is people actually misunderstood how much risk they were prepared to take on, and they were actually over-invested in growth assets like shares and property, and they hadn't thought about the sleep at night test. And when, you know, the inevitable downturn happened, they were the people that were most likely to panic and the people most likely to jump out and the people most likely to lose money, you know, which is not where we want to be.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Now, the other final point I'll make about asset allocation is that if you did know your asset allocation and you had it right before the market had its little downturn, it's probably out of whack now. So, you know, if you were a typical investor, you know, in a balanced portfolio, you might have had 70% of your assets in growth assets like shares at January last year, and you would have had about 30% in defensive assets like cash and bonds. What you would probably find now with the downturn is that that's gone to 60% growth assets, 40% defensive assets. So you're actually out of whack. We've run some numbers on this, and we believe if you don't get it right and get it back to that 70-30, that you could miss out on somewhere in the order of 10% in your returns.
Okay.
So, key action, get your asset allocation right. If you did have it right before the downturn, your action is actually now to go and reset it and make sure you're invested in line with it appropriately.
Right.
All right. So that's number one, asset allocation. The second thing you can do to revive your money is to strip any unnecessary fees and costs from your investments. Now, from what we see, we believe most people pay too much for their investments and their super. Typical fees in the market, around about 2.5%, but it's not unusual, and I had this just yesterday, I had a client come in, and she is paying at the moment a 5% contribution fee on her superannuation fund. Now, what that means is every time she puts money into her superannuation fund, the fund whacks her 5%. So that's $50 for every $1,000 that she's paying away in fees. I know where I'd rather have that $50.
Yeah.
Even if I spent it on shoes. Yeah. It's better than a fund manager having it, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you there.
Now, a lot of people think, you know, a percent here, a percent there, it won't make that much difference. It does. If you allow costs to feed on your money, then your money will become a lot less than you'd like over time. My key message here is that small percentage declines in your annual returns will compound into large percentage declines, probably larger than you expect, in your money over time. Now, I'm going to give you a quick example. Let's take three friends. We've got Kramer, we've got Jerry, and we've got Elaine. I'm sure you all know them. Let's assume that 10 years ago they all invested $100,000, and each year they earned an average return of 8%, so they all get exactly the same return. They've got the same investment portfolio and they've got the same amount of risk. So everything is exactly the same. The only difference is the fees that they pay. Now Kramer, poor old Kramer, he's paying 3% on his. Jerry, he's paying 2%. Elaine, smart girl, she's just paying 1% on her fees. After 10 years, so we're just talking 10 years, Kramer, with his fees of 3% compared with Elaine with fees of 1, has lost over $34,000 compared with Elaine. So he's got $100,000 as an investment. It's grown the same amount in terms of returns as Elaine, but he's had a cut in his fees, and that's meant that the value of his portfolio is $34,000 less than hers for the same amount of risk.
That's amazing.
And it's incredible, isn't it?
On the back of what you're saying there, when I sat down with you, Kate, you know, for everybody listening today, when I sat down and went through one of Kate's consultations, and it is amazing when you plug your figures in and look at what a tiny, weeny little percent, you know, the significant impact it can have on your superannuation or your investments or, you know, whatever your goals are, enormous differences like that. And, you know, it's that little 1% in the small writing after you sign the paper that you don't really notice, and yet when you come to retirement, it makes such a massive difference on the quality of your life, for example.
Yes. And that's true, and it's true of investments, super, and insurances, which we won't cover today, but, you know, I'm absolutely passionate about this. There are ways that you can invest your money well and pay lower fees, and, you know, I will do everything I can to try and help people to achieve that, because it does make such a difference to the money in your pocket. Yeah. All right, number three, the third thing that you need to be aware of is hidden taxes. Now, I'm not going to try and describe this in too much detail because it is quite a complex area, but let me just do my best. The hidden taxes in ordinary money investments in particular come from excessive trading. And this is where an investment manager who's managing your money is trying to generate greater additional returns by buying and selling shares short term. Now, that might sound like a good thing that they're actually trying to get you greater returns, but the problem is the manager is focused on pre-tax returns and it has an impact on you from a post-tax point of view. Now the reason for that is that when they do this short-term selling, they realise capital gains. But the capital gains are not allowed to have the 50% discount that we get in Australia on capital gains tax. Instead, 100% of the gain is taxed at your marginal tax rate. And so what that means is that this year there will be people out there who will get a year-end statement showing that the value of their account has actually dropped and they'll have a tax bill as well. So, if that's something you're worried
about,
it tends to be a bigger problem with active managers. So managers, if you ever see in an investment manager's blurb that they try and outperform the index, they're the key words, that gives you a hint that they may be turning over the portfolio a lot. So the way that you can avoid it is to look for low turnover funds. Now, these are not reported anywhere, but what you want to do is look for funds that talk about minimising short-term trading, that they buy and hold for the longer term. So these are key words, that they buy and hold for the longer term. And a good rule of thumb is to look at index funds. So index funds or passive funds, because they tend to be low turnover. The other bonus with those is they tend to be lower cost too. So that's just a general tip with investing. If you're looking for low turnover, avoid the hidden taxes and get the bonus of low cost, index funds are a very, very good way to go.
Great. God, I'm busy scribbling down notes. I'm going to have lots of homework to do when we get off this call. I think if the call stopped there, I've just got so much information. Thank you. But we have got lots more questions to plough through, so I'll keep going. Okay, question number two for you is, I love this one. I feel guilty that I'm not doing more to save for when I retire. So do I. Should I be worried?
Yes, and there are people out there who say this quite often. And it's hard to answer. And it depends on so many variables, you know, your current savings, your current cash flow, your time to retirement, how much income you've got, the type of lifestyle you want. I was actually chatting to a lady who runs a business in Sydney yesterday, and she was saying, you know, I feel like I'm going to be working till I'm 80 or 90 anyway, and I want to focus my money on building my business. You know, should I actually shift my focus? And, you know, maybe for her, maybe the answer right now is no. You know, you really, if your business is your passion and you want to get it up and going, then for now, focus on that. But keep in mind that you don't want to put off for too long preparing for your longer term and your retirement. A couple of key points to note, and I talk a lot about this to business owners. You need to look after yourself. You know, often as business owners, we do plow a lot of our time and our energy and our effort and our passion and blood, sweat and tears into our business. We do need to actually make sure that we provide for our longer term as well. And don't count just on the value of the sale of your business eventually as being your retirement fund. Second thing to note is that superannuation in Australia is concessionally taxed, despite what the government did to it last night, which wasn't actually too bad. But it is worth taking advantage of those concessions. Again, if you've got the surplus cash flow, super can be a very, very tax-effective way to invest. Regardless of that, as I said before, the key message is that the sooner you start, the longer you've got to leverage the power of compounding. Now, I'm sure everybody's heard of compounding. It's, you know, when you earn interest on interest. I'm going to just again run through a simple example with you just to show the difference that getting in early can make. Now, let's take Carrie and Charlotte. Now, Carrie, she starts investing at age 25. Charlotte starts investing at age 35. So they're still, you know, pretty young. They both invest $2,000 a year, which is around about $40 a week. Carrie invests for 10 years. After 10 years, so she's age 35, she goes, you know what, blow this. I'm not doing this. I'm not investing another cent. And she leaves the balance, and any cash she's got left over, she spends on shoes and clothes. Charlotte, on the other hand, diligently continues to invest for 30 years. At age 65, who do you think is better off? So is it Carrie or is it Charlotte? Now, logic tells us it should be Charlotte. She was the diligent one, and she actually invested $40,000 more along the way. Yet, believe it or not, it was Carrie who ends up with more wealth, and she's $70,000 better off at age 65.
Gosh.
Now, that's blow away,
yeah.
But this is just the power of compounding. It's the power of getting in early and getting your money to work for you. So, key message, the longer your money remains invested, the harder it can work for you and the less you have to work for it, which I always think is kind of nice.
Wow, if you know what I was talking about, one thing to take away from today in action, and well, that's mine. That's amazing. Thank you so much. Okay, question number three. People talk about tapping into the money vault above you. The money will flow to you when you create an idea that provides value to people. Can you explain this, please?
This is a great question. I really like this one, and I actually have to admit, I had to go and Google the money vault because I hadn't heard of that specific term before. But as soon as I did, I got the gist of what it's about. In terms of that concept of tapping into the money vault, I've actually heard it talked about in two ways. So I'm going to walk through both of those. The first relates to a concept called the law of attraction. And in essence, what this law says is that whatever you put your attention to, your mind to, it becomes reality in your life. Now, some of you may have heard of a lady called Rhonda Byrne and her book, and I think she did a movie of this called The Secret. So you'll be familiar with this view from that. So what she says is that if you want to attract money, then you have to actually focus on wealth. And what she notes is that once you focus on wealth, you then are conscious about actions that help you to work towards that, achieving that goal. The second interpretation of this concept of tapping into the money vault is actually totally pragmatic. To do well in business, you actually have to solve problems for people. So if you've found something annoying or difficult in your life as a consumer, the chances are that somebody else will have too, and therefore you've got an opportunity to make a lot of money if you can find a way to solve that problem, to save people time and effort. So in terms of the answer to this question, you know, about will money flow to you if you tap into this money vault, I actually think that the answer is a combination of the two. So the first one is, you know, you need to believe in your idea, this law of attraction thing. You need to be passionate about it. There has to be something that is important to you and that you're prepared to focus on and give your attention to. But secondly, a great idea without meeting a market need is literally a dead duck. And in fact, that's one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make in business. You know, they go and they set up a new business because they're passionate about something, but they actually fail to understand some of the basics, which is who their target market is. So, you know, who are those people out there who have a problem that needs to be solved? Secondly, what's the fit between the offer that they're going to put out there from their business and that target market? So what's the pain they're going to solve and how are they going to do it? And then thirdly, why would people buy them? Why would they select and pay them to solve that pain rather than finding a different solution? Now, I suppose in answering this, I'm actually stepping right outside financial advice and into marketing, but I feel quite comfortable with this because this is the basis on which I've set up my business, Multiforte. And interestingly, I'm, together with my business partner, actually going through assessing another business opportunity right as we speak. So it is a topic quite close to my heart. So let me share with you my five practical tips around this. Number one, if you have an idea or if you're looking for an idea, work out what problem it could solve and for who. So what problem can you solve and for who? Now, it doesn't have to be that creative or out there, interestingly. Often if you can offer a solution that solves a problem in a, you know, a better, a faster, a cheaper, an easier way, then you may have a winner on your hands. Number two, make sure you understand your competitive environment. So I have seen so many people go into business without actually checking out what else is on offer that your target market can use to solve their problem. And that could be that they can do it themselves. It could be that there's a substitute product, you know, so there's a, another offer in the market that could do solve the problem in a different way, as well as current competitors. So number two, understand your competitive environment. Number three, and you'll hear this in every marketing textbook, but I believe this passionately, be clear on what is unique or different about your offer. And do this from the perspective of your target market. What will they value about your offering? Why is your offer going to be a better, faster, cheaper, or easier way to solve whatever it is that's causing them pain? Number four, understand your pricing model. And this is getting financial, and this is very, very important. To be successful, you have to be able to make a sustainable profit. So not just a profit in year one, or I'm going to aim for a profit in year five. This is a sustainable profit. And this is important too if you are thinking about your business as a saleable entity, something you want to sell at some point in the future. You need to understand your product or service costs, so your inputs, and then you need to understand what price your market is prepared to pay. And then you need to actually quantify if you've got an adequate profit margin. So you need to know what your inputs are, what your product or service costs are. You need to understand what price you can charge, and then obviously your profit margin. And the final one, number five, and this is very much into phase territory, but set realistic goals about what you want to achieve. You know, if you're going to do this, be clear and set strategies to help you then work towards those goals. Now, I'm finding in the current market environment that this is extremely powerful. What we did in our business at, in January in Multiforte was set goals for the year, and we're just working on the strategies that we set out at that time. And what it does for me is it enables me to stay focused on what I want to achieve with my business and not to get sidelined. Not to get sidelined by the doom and gloom or the naysayers that are out there. So, number five, Faye, set realistic goals.
And that, you know, it's absolutely everything you said there, you know, from a general coaching perspective and the business coaching clients that I work with, you know, I reinforce every single point that you said. Absolutely great advice. With the realistic goals, you know, that applies to any part of your life, but it also fits in with the law of attraction because you are focusing on what you want and therefore your subconscious mind works and focuses on it too as well as your conscious mind. You know, from a financial perspective, you probably get a lot, Kate, you know, people saying, I don't want to be poor or I don't want to lose money or I don't want X, Y, and Z when it comes to their finances. And when you think about the law of attraction and actually how your subconscious mind works, that means you're actually focusing on what you don't want all of the time. So your mind can't process negatives. So when you say, I don't want to be poor, I don't want to lose money, your mind can't actually process that don't word. So it goes straight into focusing on what you've been trying to avoid the whole time. And so when you set goals and positive goals, your both sides of your brain get to focus on what you actually want, and you've got, you know, a much higher chance of actually getting there when you set a positive goal that you're working towards. So brilliant advice. I love it. Thank you very much. Wow, we're running out of time, aren't we? I better speed things up a little bit. Okay, question number four. I'm not very good at budgeting. How do I get control of my spending? I was going to say here, well, if you get married, then that's going to help you budgeting, because I am just, swamped with trying to deal with wedding budgets at the moment. But that's maybe not something I would advise. So over to you, Kate, for some good practical advice.
All right, this comes up all the time. And, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but, you know, budgeting is still an issue for people who earn huge six-figure salaries. So it's not just when you're feeling like, you know, you're not earning a big enough income. It's a fundamental discipline. Now, we talked about goals. What I want you to do is think of a budget not as a chore, but as a planning device. So it's a means of setting and reaching your goals. And what I'm really passionate about with Multiforte is helping people to understand that money is an enabler to help you achieve the things that you want in life. And I love this guy called Joe Dominguez, who wrote a book called Your Money or Your Life a number of years ago. And I actually really love his take on money and spending. This guy retired at age 31 and didn't work for money again. Now, he accumulated a nest egg, but it was only about, you know, $400,000, $500,000 in today's terms. So that's not huge. But he just worked out that he could actually live a fairly reasonable, simple life without needing a huge amount of money. So his definition of money, I love, it is something that you trade your life energy for. So money is something you trade your life energy for. And if you think about it, that's what we do when we work. You know, we actually trade our time, our life energy for income from an employer or from our own business. And for me, it clarifies beautifully what money should be about, and it actually makes my spending decisions much clearer. So, you know, if I'm dreaming about that fantastic pair of boots that I've just seen down in a campus store, you can tell I've got a slight obsession with shoes. I can actually stand there and say, is this worth trading my life energy for? Or do I want to retain that life energy? So it sounds, Faye said before, I'm into yoga. It sounds very yogic, but to me it makes sense, and it actually helps you to make decisions about how you spend your money. Whether you take that on or not is completely up to you, but let me move on to my 7-step plan to help you get your money under control and create a budget. So step number one, choose goals that you can get excited about, because that will make you determined to reach them, and that will help you to actually use budgeting effectively. Be very clear on what the goals mean. So, you know, financial security might be a good term to use, but it's not actually personal. So, you know, you might want to say, I will work a 4-day week by 2014. Or maybe you want to have $5,000 a year for a fabulous holiday. Or maybe you want $1 million share portfolio by the time you're 50. Whatever it is, think about it in personal terms. Write it down. Make it specific. Then think about if there are expenses that you're willing to trade today to achieve these goals in the future. And that comes back to that whole idea of what you're prepared to trade in terms of your life energy. Second step, do a financial inventory. And this is simply about your assets and liabilities. So work out what you own, your assets, and what you owe, your liabilities. Step number three, record where your money goes. And this is all about your cash flow. And what I'd like you to do is focus on your areas of what I call fixed spending and then your variable spending. So fixed spending is pretty easy. So this is your mortgage, your rent, your car, your insurance premiums, things that you really have to pay, and they tend to be the same amount and they tend to be regular expenses. Your variable spending is about tracking the items which you have a bit more variability and control, and that's things like your gas, your electricity, your groceries, clothing, gifts, personal care, transport, all of that sort of stuff. This is often where you'll find easy pickings for cost cutting. Now, getting a handle on that sort of variable spending can be a little bit challenging, and what I suggest that you do is just carry a notepad around and track your spending, or, you know, keep your receipts or whatever works for you, but actually track what you're spending every day for a few weeks in a small notebook and get an idea of where your money's actually going, and that will help you to spot leaks and also help
education. It's such an education doing that exercise. I would highly recommend it to anyone, because I remember when I started out Shine Up and I did that for about a month, and it was just amazing where I was just throwing little bits of money here, there and everywhere, but when you add it all up, it's quite significant. So it can be a little bit tedious. It's a little bit like time management, writing a time diary, but you just don't know what you don't know until you do those kind of diaries and track what you're spending.
Yeah, and you're right. It's the only way to actually get a clear view, and you need that for the next step, step four, which is to actually then review what you're spending. And the key thing here is to work out what are the big ticket items that represent the highest percentage of your spending. Now, we actually have a budget tool that people can fill in, and it automatically calculates that for you. So you can very quickly see that, you know, 20% of your money, for instance, goes in rent or mortgage, or it might be higher. But it gives you a percentage, and so you get a real feel for the chunks of money and where it's going. You can then look at those and go, well, is there an opportunity to reduce any of them? And the benefit here is that a very small percentage change in a big expense can make quite a significant difference. A good example is a client of mine. She and her husband have no children, just the two of them, and they have two cars. And so one of the things that we're trialing, they're actually trying not to use their second car to see if it makes more sense for them to run one car and reduce their expenses and then just have the occasional variable expense of public transport or a taxi. So, you know, that's one idea of how you can look at those big ticket items. The second thing on reviewing is to look at the discretionary items. And can you reduce any of them? I've got some tips under this one as well, so this is kind of like sub-tips. A, look for things that you place less value on that you could cut back on. And this is the key to budgeting. It's not about what somebody else says you should cut back on. It's what you kind of go, well, actually, you know, buying my lunch each day, I don't really enjoy the food that much. You know, I'd actually rather prepare something myself. So I'm prepared to cut back on that. But, you know, my coffee with my friends, I'm not prepared to give that up because that's actually really key. Or, you know, my Friday night drinks, it's key to my social life. Can't do without it. But even if you reduce your spend by, you know, 25% across a few things, you could actually make a big difference. Second tip on reducing these variable items, see if you can actually defer some of your purchases. So, you know, if you traditionally buy a car every 3 or 4 years, stretch it out to 5 or 6 years. Even if you just, you know, think about your great coat that you've got at wintertime or a pair of shoes, if you can make everything that you own last for 20% longer, you can actually, you know, make a difference to your money. Sounds like a little thing, but it can actually save you a heap. And number three, and I've become a very good one of these, become a bargain shopper. So shop at sale time and ask for discounts. All right, step number five. So number four was reviewing your spending. Step number five, plug your leaks. Now, there's some things you can't do much about. You probably can't do a great deal about fuel prices out there, but you can minimize the bills that you pay. So I'm going to run through a number of ideas quite quickly. Save energy. Deregulation has meant that there is the opportunity for you to do a lot with your electricity and natural gas suppliers. Often, though, you need to ask. So ring them up and ask them what they're going to do for you. And there's some great deals out there. I'm hearing about them from clients, so I know they're there. You may be able to reduce your mortgage rate. So, you know, go and see if you can refinance your mortgage. Even small differences in your interest can actually add up over time. Number three, pay off or consolidate your debt. Credit cards are horrendous. You pay 18% interest. If you've got a home loan, you know, redraw on that and pay off the credit card. Generally, it's a lower way of having debt. So that's a key one there is, you know, try not to use credit cards and hold money on them just because the interest is horrendous. Don't go shopping on the spur of the moment. You know, I've actually got a standard habit, which is if I see something that I love, I will not buy it on the spot. I actually walk away, and I have a rule where I'm not allowed to go back for 24 hours. And my standard line is always, you know, to shop assistants, I'll have a think about it. And, you know, 8 times out of 10, not every time, but 8 times out of 10, I walk away and go, you know what? My life energy ain't worth spending that.
I love it. That's very good discipline, Kate. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, and you know what's funny?
So I find it hard.
You know, the funny thing that I find with it is you feel really empowered. And so when you start doing this and you actually go, you know what? I didn't fall for that. I didn't fall for the salesperson trap. I didn't fall into my own indulgence. And you do become a much more disciplined shopper as a result. You know, I found it really empowering personally. And my last point on this one is pay with cash. They've done research into this. They find that on average you will spend around about 25% more if you always pay with credit card. So cash is king. All right, budget step six, try and target a surplus. Now, this surplus is key for you to get that investment money that you're going to get sitting there compounding away for you and working on your behalf. So what I suggest is either work out how much you can comfortably set aside each month, or work out how much you need to put aside if you want to reach a particular goal. And then give it a go. Try it out. See if you can actually meet it. You may actually find after a couple of months, as you get used to it, you're able to put more money aside. Final step, step number seven, pay yourself first. Treat paying yourself first and putting away a surplus no differently to the way that you treat your rent or your mortgage. It's a no questions asked. You just have to do it. This is about looking after yourself, and it's the easiest way to do budgeting. I do not sit down and review my budget on a weekly, a monthly, or even a half-yearly basis most of the time. I generally do it annually. I sit down, I do a budget annually, I know where I'm at, and then I act in accordance with that. And only if something changes do I go back to it. But all I do is pay myself first. And it's just the simplest way. It's the lazy way to do budgeting. So if you're not into doing spreadsheets, I recommend that one.
That's good, because I'm just thinking, sorry, I'm just sort of deep in thought there, because my initial reaction is, you know, to always pay everyone else first. And I have often not even thought about my savings or, you know, actually in the context that you're talking about paying yourself first. And I think, I don't know, I'm going to generalize here, but a lot of people have that mentality. And that's certainly a mentality that needs changing if you want to really get your finances in check.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a shift. It's a, you know, you talk about habit shifts. This is a mindset and a habit shift.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before we move on to the next question, the books that you mentioned, Your Money or Your Life, I haven't read that one, but one that's definitely in line with what you were talking about at the start there is The 4-Hour Work Week. And it is such an education on how you don't have to have an absolute fortune to retire early and to live a completely different lifestyle if you want to. But it's about being smart with your money and your life energy, as you put it. So it's two really good books there to read. Okay, question number five is, my issue with money is not having a high pay currently. I want to find ways to leverage my income and create passive income. What can I do? Magic words there, passive income.
Yes, wouldn't that be nice? We'd all love that. Look, the answer to this one is simple but hard to do. And the key thing is, you know, we talked about it before, you build an investment portfolio. And initially what you would do is any earnings you get, you reinvest them and get it to build and get compounding working for you. But just to give you an example, the dividend yield, so this is the income paid from an Australian share portfolio, runs at around about 7% per annum. Now, if you had $700,000 invested in an Australian share portfolio, you could receive $50,000 per annum. You know, so they're not funny numbers. That's just a straight calculation. Anybody can sit and do that on a calculator. So that just gives you an idea that if you put the money away now, build the portfolio, it can then generate passive income for you. But you do need to obviously have the time to build it. So as I said, simple answer, but probably a little harder to actually put into practice.
Yeah. Okay. Number six. What is the best way to make money in a recession? I think everybody wants to know the answer to this one, and you've already covered it quite a lot, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about the money vault and tapping into that, and the whole idea that if you can find a problem to solve and, you know, build a business around that, then that's obviously a great way to do it. Because if you're really truly solving a market need, then your business should be relatively recession-proof. And that's probably the other idea is, you know, there are businesses out there that are pretty recession-proof. You know, believe it or not, book retailing. I also know a guy who's in property management, you know, so that's recession-proof because they always need property managers. Or the other type of businesses are those that are counter-cyclical, so when the market's down, they still do okay. Look, you know, if you've got surplus cash, you might be able to buy a business on sale in a recession, so that's often a key opportunity. And again, it can be a great time to start building an investment portfolio because, in essence, shares are on sale because they're down.
Yep. And, you know, I think something that I've come across is that there are lots of people doing very, very well in a recession. We have all the media hype that I talk about in my newsletters. But if you can, and you talked about at the start, you know, if you can remove yourself from that, there are actually some really smart businesses that are doing incredibly well. So, you don't have to think of a recession in terms of doom and gloom. There is certainly a money vault still there to be for the taking. Okay, question 7. What's the best advice you can give to someone right now who is in business for themselves about managing cash flow during slow periods?
All right. You've got to stop some spending. So that's the pain part of this, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Okay, so like we talked about budgeting, it's no different when it's your business. Do a complete review of every dollar you spend. We believe, from our experience, that most businesses, if you do this well, you can save 20% off your cost base. And it doesn't matter if you're a big business or a small business, so that's 20% off your cost base. Let me give you some examples. We walked through this with a client recently. They found that they had a service agreement for a fax machine, and that actually the physical fax machine had been gone for 2 years, but the service agreement was still in place. So that one got taken off the spend. They did some process efficiency reviews, and one of the business partners actually spent a week on the manufacturing line, and they found significant ways to cut wastage. They also, as a result of that, identified two roles that they really didn't need. So they were able to actually reduce their staff numbers. And believe it or not, this company's sales are running higher this year than they were last year. So, Faye, that goes back to what you just said about there are businesses that amazingly are doing well. Another client, we worked with them on their FPOS fees. We saved them $7,000 per annum. There's good examples out there of things that you can do. So first thing, do a complete review of every dollar you spend and make sure there's no wastage in there. You may be able to negotiate with some of your suppliers. What I'm hearing at the moment from a lot of businesses that I deal with is that there is an attitude out there that people can ask for discounts, and most businesses feel like they need to give them. So, ask for a discount. You may as well ask. As a lady I know says, if you don't ask, the answer's always no.
Yes.
in terms of what you do in your business, rationalize it to the stuff that generates income for you, particularly if you're a service-based business. So, ask yourself the question, if I stop spending time or money on X, whatever X may be, what impact will this have on my business? And if it has no impact, stop doing it and reduce the cost. Another tip is be commercial with family and friends. We see a lot of businesses that do special deals for family and friends, and this is the time to rethink it. You do need to take commercial decisions, even with family members who work in the business, even though it can be extremely hard. The reality is it will be harder if your business goes under because your cash flow stopped. One family business we deal with had to cut 3 family members from the business in order to survive. Now, they save themselves nearly $200,000 a year, but the business will be an ongoing concern. We all know staff is one of the largest costs, so regardless of whether they're family or not, you may need to put people off, and it can work for you to outsource some aspects of your business. Again, a client of ours had about 9 staff. Not only has she relocated her offices, but she's also put off all staff but 1, and she's outsourced everything to external suppliers. And what she's effectively done is shifted her fixed costs in her business, so staff is a fixed cost, to variable costs. So she now pays per item or per use with the outsourced providers. So that's been quite a clever one for her. There's a number of ways. So I hope that they're very practical tips, but I hope that helps just from our experience with those.
Yeah, I agree completely from the clients that I work with. And again, 4-hour work week gives some brilliant examples of outsourcing and how you can run a really great business from a one-man band by outsourcing practically everything. And it also allows you to go on holiday much more regularly, which I like the idea of. And finally, question 8. I'd like my accountant to be more proactive. What can I do?
If I had a dollar for every time I'd heard this one, I'd be very rich. We hear this a lot. And look, I want to come to the defence of the accountants out there. Their role is to keep you compliant from a tax perspective. Their role is not to project forward. And in fact, their licensing doesn't allow them to do so. And in fact, if they're a financial advisor, they can, because that's specifically the role of the financial advisor. So our license actually allows us to make assumptions and take information and then build financial projections going forward. So in essence, the two roles should work quite closely together. So the accountant is more of a rear view mirror role. They look backwards and they ensure that the way that you've handled your money in the business is compliant and meets the tax requirements. And the role of the financial advisor is much more forward looking. So typically, again, particularly with business clients or even some of our PAYG clients, we will work very closely with their accountant to make sure that we align across both services. So in terms of an advisor, I just wanted to finish off by giving you some tips on what to look for. And this, again, comes from a lot of the things that I hear in the marketplace about why people don't particularly like going to see financial advisors. And from some of the stuff that you read in the media, I fully understand it. The first thing is you need to ensure that the advice that you receive is practical and it's in your best interest. And the things that you need to look out for, so these are the warning signs. When somebody's trying to push products on you, trying to sell you a product, and you didn't really think you needed one, or there's some restrictions on the products that are available. That's a sign that there's an incentive or commissions in place or some sort of sales volume bonus that the advisor is trying to meet, which means that the advice is probably in his or her best interest and not yours. So make sure the advice is in your best interest. Tip number two on getting advice is ongoing service should be your choice. Now, a lot of advisors out there get inbuilt or trail commissions, and you need to look out for these and you need to ask about these. You need to ask, what ongoing commissions do you receive from the products that you recommend? And you should have the ability to turn that off at any time. And sometimes people can get locked into products, particularly insurance products, where there are ongoing commissions that can be as high as 30% of the premiums that you pay. And that comes right back to what we talked about before, about not paying unnecessary fees or charges, because you're not getting service for that. So you have to have the ability to actually turn off ongoing service. Third thing, you need to feel comfortable with your advice. A lot of people don't feel like they're an expert in advice. That's okay. But my two key messages for you on this are, do not invest in anything that you don't understand. You know, ask every question under the sun and feel comfortable asking questions. But if you still don't understand it and you don't feel you're getting a clear explanation, do not proceed, because there's probably something there that will trip you up. This is your money and you need to be very, very aware of how you're investing and how you're looking after it. So that's it in a nutshell. What you need to look for in advice that's in your best interest, number one, that ongoing service must be your choice and you have the ability to say yay or nay, and number three, that you feel comfortable with what you're doing.
Great advice. And number three really resonates with me, and I think, you know, having sat down and worked with you, you have a great knack, and I think you've demonstrated that completely today, of talking to people in the language that they speak. So they understand you, and it's not full of terms and acronyms, and you end up at the end of a meeting having no idea what you're about to sign your life away to. So really great advice throughout the entire hour, Kate, but don't invest in anything you don't understand, and work with someone that you like working with, and don't feel pressured into anything. You know, it goes for kind of any service, and certainly as a coach, that's what I say to my clients. But I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think a lot of people end up signing on the dotted line and not really having any idea what they've just signed up for.
Yeah, no, I think it's very true. So, and, you know, quite frankly, and you would feel the same, I'm sure, and I'm sure many people on the line do, that as a service provider, you want to deal with people who you feel like you're providing value to and you've got a good relationship, because, you know, at the end of the day, it comes right back to the life energy thing. It should be fun.
Absolutely. Completely. It's no fun working with someone that doesn't understand what you do, they're not really sure why they're on board with you, or really, you know, you come from the perspective of trying to sell them something rather than working in partnership to try and achieve their goals. So where on earth is that hour gone, Kate? Thank you so much.
That was
unfortunately the last question we've got time for, so I trust for everyone on the call and listening to the recording today, you got a lot of value from the great advice and very practical tips that Kate's given us. I know that I certainly have. Now, as I mentioned, Kate's got a very generous bonus for everybody that's listening to the call today and for people listening to the recording, and that's a free individual 30-minute consultation with one of the partners at Multiforte, which also includes Kate. And during that 30-minute consultation, they'll provide you with some general advice and guidance during the consultation. So ideally that's a face-to-face meeting, but it can be done over the phone if convenient. That's right, isn't it, Kate?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Great. So to take advantage of this offer, please email Kate, and I'll give you her email address now, so pens at the ready. It's Kay McCallum, so KMCCALLUM at multiforte.com.au, or you can call 02-8209-1607, and I'll be sending you all of Kate's contact details in an email tomorrow with the recording of this call as well. So in addition to that fabulous bonus, you'll also receive the recording of this call from me tomorrow, so that you can listen to Kate's advice again. And I really, from an advanced learning and accelerated learning perspective, I highly recommend you listen to this call at least once, but ideally twice, because you really will absorb new information, new tips every time you listen to the call. Kate packed a huge amount of information into 60 minutes today, so please do listen to it again. You'll also receive complimentary subscription to the Multiforte and Outshine Consulting newsletters. And for those of you who have already subscribed, you'll know that they're packed full of top tips to help you master your personal and professional success. So please make sure you have a read from those. So certainly it's been my absolute pleasure to host this call today, and I want to say a very big thank you to you, Kate, for giving up your time to share with us very valuable tips and strategies. Thank you so much. You've, as always, been an inspiration, and your advice is invaluable. So thank you very much for joining us. And I'll just give you an opportunity to sign off and say your goodbyes now, Kate.
All right. We just want to say thank you very much. As I said, I found the questions were fantastic, because they are exactly in the space that I believe we should be thinking about money, which is this integration between money and our life and just understanding that dynamic. So thank you all, and I hope that it's been helpful for you.
Brilliant. Thank you. So thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you for letting Kate and I into your homes and offices today. My name's Faye Hollands from OutshineConsulting.com, and I really do hope our paths cross again. Until then, have a fabulous evening, and we look forward to talking to you again soon. Bye-bye.